Welcome, everybody, to a very special edition of the Nerd Watch podcast. We are here with a comic book writing legend this evening. And before I introduce him, let me introduce the people that are sitting with me this evening here on the Nerd Watch podcast tonight. Todd Bernardi, author of the Kukui Project and the artist on the Kukui Project. Also joining us tonight is Amy. She's in the house. She's incredibly talented herself, and she brought the guest with her. So thank you. Appreciate that very much.
No problem.
Of course, Alika, the man who owns Maui Comics and Collectibles.
Hello.
333 Derry Road right here in Kahului. And I, of course, am G Money, and we are so glad you could be with us. But ladies and gentlemen, the man of the hour this time on the podcast is a very famous writer, legendary storylines, and the creator of Venom. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. David Michelinie is in the house this evening. So glad you can make it with us, sir.
Aloha. I'm glad to be here.
I'm glad you could make it. So first off, how are you liking Maui so far?
I love it. It's great.
You having a good time?
Yeah.
Oh, good, good, good. So I'm going to try and make this as pain-free as possible for you.
That's going to be hard with
right.
Alika here.
Alika's here. We're going to try and help. We're going to try and...
especially with customer questions.
Customer
it's
questions.
Get a little painful.
If you have any questions for Mr. Michelinie, Todd, please feel free to ask him.
Okay.
But first, before any of you guys ask him, I do have a couple of questions for you. First off, what got you into this line of business? What were you reading as a youngster? What were the things that inspired you to become a comic book writer or a writer per se?
I love to read. I read novels and short stories and all kinds of things.
Right, right.
And I never thought about being a comic book writer because I didn't realize people wrote them. They didn't have credits back then.
That seems like back a common thread of people of that generation.
Yeah, yeah. So it was only when I was in college and rediscovered comics and Marvel Comics, which had the writer, the penciler, the inker, the letterer and stuff. Oh, they don't just push a button and the comics come out. Okay. So, but I read mostly science fiction, fantasy, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Comic books, I like the off-the-wall characters more than superheroes. I read, Rip Hunter, Time Master, Challengers of the Unknown, Sea Devils, Space Ranger, all those. A little bit of Superman stuff, but most of the off-the-wall characters.
Now, when as you were reading these adventure sci-fi adventure stories, when did
that was a cool list, man?
Yeah, that was. when did it click in your head that man, I want to do this? When did that happen?
That happened in college when I found out people wrote them.
nice.
But I wanted to be a writer. But I always expected to write, prose. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted that since I was a little kid because it was such a wonderful thing to read these stories, mm-hmm. and be drawn into them. And just, I was just so wonderful. And the only thing more wonderful is that if I could do that myself,
right?
If I could write these stories and have other people read them and enjoy them. So I wanted to be, back when my friends wanted to be cowboys and policemen and astronauts, I wanted to be a writer. So I was kind of an outcast because who else wanted that? But I always say, how many of those kids became cowboys and astronauts? But I became a writer.
Right.
So it's ever since I was a little kid, I wanted to write.
It's fascinating because that would be the true definition of you would be the precursor to an actual nerd, which is really cool because you are, and that's such an endearing, term of endearment, as a matter of fact.
And the nowadays fact, it is.
Nowadays it is. Back in the day, it certainly wasn't.
That was like, but you get beat up three times a week. Or
what's
something.
Amazing
four.
To me is four. What's amazing to me is that knowing at such a young age that you wanted to be a writer. Were you writing little stories, say, in elementary and in high school?
Oh, dear God, yes. Yeah? But don't ask me that.
No, not at all.
Me and a friend who lived up the street wrote little stories of, I think, Sherlock Holmes instead of Sherlock Holmes. I think we stole it from Mad Magazine's Sherlock, if he ever solves mm-hmm. a mystery. And stuff like that, little parodies. And mm-hmm. my mom, who was an office manager and had access to a mimeograph machine,
right.
would mimeograph them, and we'd make covers out of
that means
cut up.
Copies exist in the world. Sorry, the collector in me just got excited.
Oh, dear God. So, and I would take them to school and sell them for a nickel until I got caught. and they threw them all away and called my parents in because you're not supposed to sell stuff on. It was just an elementary school, so it was the first time I got in trouble, and I liked it.
You're a rebel writer.
Yeah, that's true. I'm kind of seditious.
Rebel rouser.
What's the first thing that you remember that you wrote, or what direction were you going when I know you. I'm assuming you're going to write, like you said, prose. You're going to write a book.
Yeah.
What were your ideas for those stories, or what was the very first idea you thought, hey, listen, I got something here. I'm going to make it pop.
You know, like I said, I was writing those bad parodies, and as I got older, I wrote even worse poetry. And then I think I wrote a story, a science fiction prose story, mm-hmm. that it was better than the poetry, but not by much. And it was only after I got out of college that I started writing, you know.
Right. Oh,
sorry. Just,
no.
Someone poked their head in the door.
Sorry, don't worry about it. No
it spoke to me. Yeah. So I found out, people write comics. Maybe I can do that.
Sure.
Because I loved reading them. And I could – I learned how – because I had my college training was in television and film, and I'd written some scripts by that point. So
I ask what you wrote? What scripts you wrote?
Nothing that ever was broadcast, but no, I wrote one called Oculus, which was a 90-minute pilot for an investigator of the supernatural, and I submitted it to the networks, and it was ignored by most, but turned down by one because they said they had something similar in the work. I think that was the
Night Stalker.
No, God, no. I wish. I wouldn't mind losing to that, but it's something I think was called The Sixth Sense before the movie came out.
Oh,
It lasted, I think, 4 weeks or something. So that was about it until I started trying to write comics.
Now, when you take that turn from going, okay, this spec script thing isn't working out, I want to be a writer, I want to do this, was your idea to make an impact in the world of comics the way you have? Because like you said, you were writing things that weren't necessarily related to superheroes.
True.
So when you wanted to break into the comic book business, was there an idea that you had that thought maybe that you could break through with that wasn't superheroes, or were you going to just go with, hey, listen, I think I can make something better of these heroes?
Oh, I didn't think I could make something better of it. Wasn't that presumptuous?
Oh, of course.
I thought I had some ideas, yeah, but I didn't, you know, take them and say, "Hey, guys, I got something. Your next hero here, your next million seller." I was lucky to get in, and I listened to what they wanted, and mm-hmm. I gave them what they wanted until I got the chance of creating something myself.
Yeah, we'll talk about your million seller a little later in this show.
What was your first original character that you created for a major publisher? Mm. DC was who you were with first, right?
Yeah, I worked for them for about 5 years. I created two series for them, one called Claw the Unconquered, which was a sword and sorcery series, and Star Hunters, which was a science fiction series. Again, no superheroes.
Oh, very cool. Now, curiously, just because I'm extremely interested, mm-hmm. what's it like in a writing room in a comic book for writing when you go, did they just throw you guys in or did they just throw you, say, listen, come up with something with this. I need something by the end of this month that I need to put out in the comics. Here's some of the art they're thinking about using. How does that work? How do you put that together?
Well, for the first 10 months when I first started working for DC Comics, I did exclusively short stories for the mystery books, House of Mystery, House of Secrets, basically.
Which are incredible.
Incredible, yeah.
It's like you do so much magic with like 7 or 8 pages.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It was a learning experience, believe me. But yeah, but they had, it was also a learning opportunity because they had like 3 stories in each issue. And so I was told that if they let you try and it's a clunker, they can put it between 2 better stories and still, still
that's
sell
the book.
That's
a very smart publishing.
So I did that for 10 months. So I just didn't say we want this, we want that. I had to come up with ideas for 5 to 10 page stories about vampires and monsters and supernatural stuff. So I did that for 10 months. And then they offered me the Unknown Soldier series and Star Spangled War stories. And at that point, they said, okay, we want some good stuff. The war stuff, you have to stay in this. I had some guidelines, but they pretty much said, I mean, I kind of I read what had been gone before,
right?
And some things that didn't make sense to me, I changed, and I came up with what I thought I was. This was basically, I came through the Vietnam War era in college, so I was very anti-war, and it was just such a great opportunity to tell war stories. I mean, not preach, you know, war no more, you know, anything like this, but do a story set in war to show how bad it is, and what it, more importantly, what it affected the people, both the soldiers and both sides, but the people that weren't in the war and how they were affected by it. So they gave me some pretty much gave me freedom to do that. So I don't know, they said, here's your artist. It was Jerry Talayoc, one of the Filipino artists. And I looked at it and said, oh, okay, I'll take that, because he was terrific. And
is that a rush, I mean, for you? I mean, when your stories come to life on that page by someone else's hand, is that a rush? I mean, when you look at it and you go, and then inspires you to do something else? Or
I'll tell you something. I was so disappointed when my first work came out.
Oh, really?
Because I didn't get a rush. And I realized, here's this comic book. I wrote it. It's professional. It's published. It's got my name on it. And I wasn't thrilled.
Oh, wow.
I was disappointed. I finally realized, because that's not what I did. What I did was the script. Mm. And then when it came in on the art, that's when I got my thrill. Because this is my story. It's come to life.
Right.
And so by the time it came out, it was I was detached from it. And so I don't get that thrill when something I've written comes out. But when it's, you know, in manuscript form, when it's drawn in comics, that's when I get my thrill.
Yeah, that's what I was curious. Seeing your work come to life.
Yes, absolutely.
That, I mean, that must be a thrill, an absolute thrill to see
yes.
that. Now, those Star Spangled War stories, they were fairly successful. They were extremely successful.
Oh, it's a huge popular title.
Right, exactly.
I've got them.
Well, thank you.
That was in the early 70s or mid-70s?
Yeah, 73, 74 is when I started. I think.
My mentor, Bruce Ellsworth, was known for actually discovering the Salida collection,
right.
The Blanket Salida collection, which was all war and early sci-fi stuff.
So when does DC come up and go, hey, Michelinie, we're going to put you on this. We're going to put you on another project. How long before the success of that, when do they go, hey, listen, we're going to put you on something else?
I don't remember the timeline, how long I was on Unknown Soldier, but my absolute favorite comic at that time was Swamp Thing. I love Bernie Wrightson's artwork. Lin Wein was so incredibly literate. His writing, it was a huge influence, because you'd read that and everything wove together beautifully, and he used such wonderful language. Mm. And then they said, okay, we want you to write Swamp Thing. And, you know, when I woke up from fainting, okay. And I tell you, every time I had to write or plot an issue, I sat down and I reread all 13, I think it was, of Lin's stories. Mm. I tried to absorb them. I tried to be as close as possible. I never succeeded in his level of quality, but by trying to emulate it, it improved the level of my quality immensely. And that was my second series.
That was with Nestor Redondo.
Correct, yeah. He was terrific, too.
Yeah. I mean, if you had to pick some guy that could do Bernie Wrightson, he did a really good job.
Yeah, it was a great storyteller, beautiful artwork.
Really refreshing to hear the way you're talking about it, because, I mean, you know, you're you, so you live through it. So you're like, oh, I learned a lot from working with Lin Wein, whereas nowadays people hear David Michelinie and they think, you know, you're a contemporary of all these major creators and writers within the Marvel Universe, and, you know, have earned your spot there. So it's cool to hear, like, from the beginning, from how it was from your point of view.
Right.
Oh, okay.
I searched out the Star Spangled stuff because my growing up, when I was really young, I was into Batman, you know, 5, 6, 7. Then I got into, like, the darker superheroes as I got older. But growing up, my dad, I was like, Dad, what kind of comic books did you like to read when you were growing up? And he was like, I just read the war comics. I never really actually read superhero stuff.
No.
So I never, but by in the 90s, there was no war comics going on. You know, it was all superhero stuff.
Yeah.
So I finally was able to come across them. And I think that they're really amazing stories. And it's really interesting because they're common to an era where, you know, you during the, I mean, if it was 73, that was like the end of Vietnam.
The end of the Vietnam War. There was a lot of war books during that time.
Yeah. So you can really, you can kind of, it's almost like, for me, it's kind of as underground as Marvel or DC wanted to get, you know, because they were doing, it wasn't as subversive as like Zap Comics or anything, but it was still something that wasn't superhero. It wasn't Captain America, you know? So I just really admire the storytelling in those.
Thank you for Jerry Talaoke and me.
Well, for those, I'm assuming that the Comics Code was happening at that time.
It's kind of useless by that point.
But I was going to say, it was pretty much useless because those are some very hardcore, you know, true to life stories.
It was kind of like a resurgence. I mean, I didn't live through it, of course. I'm just going back, looking at the titles. A resurgence of, like, you know, because EC Comics, they, you know, they had war stories. They had gruesome, you know, sci-fi and horror and whatever. And the Comics Code ended that. And then the 70s, when people stopped even really caring about the Comics Code, a lot of that good stuff started coming back.
Right, right.
And they started doing it. Like, I mean, that's, you know, Swamp Thing and everything during that era.
Well, I'm one of those guys that think that Swamp Thing is... He's one of my favorite characters in the DC universe. He's quite an amazing character to read about, to read his comics, and to just... you kind of stand in awe of that guy. He doesn't get enough credit in the DC universe, in my opinion. I'm assuming your first hero, superhero, yes? Or
I didn't consider it superheroes. He was a monster.
Sure.
So
right.
It would be more horror, but not standard horror.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was a hero, but it wasn't a superhero. He was a reluctant hero who was a guy who got turned into a bunch of muck.
Right, right, right. Now when that how long were you on Swamp
I did
before?
Seven issues. I think I did five, and then there was a fill-in, and I did two more. But and for the first time ever, as far as I know, they're being reprinted in October in an omnibus. So people who never knew that I had written Swamp Thing might discover that, hey, I wrote Swamp Thing.
Is there a name for the arc that we can look for?
It didn't have an arc.
Oh, okay.
At that point, the word arc wasn't used.
Sure,
You know, continuity and subplots and stuff. So,
was that around the time, were there inklings or rumblings of the Swamp Thing movie or something happening in Hollywood with the character at that time when you were writing it?
I don't remember that I was aware of anything.
Well, okay.
It may have been right after I left.
It could. Yeah, I was just thinking because Wes Craven did it in 1984, I believe, the Swamp Thing film, I believe. Hmm. But so you do seven issues of Swamp Thing, and from there you move to what other what was your next book there?
Wow.
Or next, well, I should say, the next most influential book at DC for you.
Well, I guess with the two series that I created, because I did a couple of issues of Phantom Stranger, three fill-ins of Jonah Hex, and I guess I was the guy who they went to when they had something besides superheroes to do.
Well, that must have been nice for
cool.
you. Yeah, which must have been cool for you.
Yeah, I did do six Aquaman stories, and he's sort of a superhero, and three Superboy stories. But then I was going, well, you ask, what did I want to do? Do I want to make an impact? Now, I had three goals when I first started. First, I wanted to sell a story. Mm. If I would sell a story, it was published, I would go home, and I would not consider myself a failure. Mm. I did it. The second one was to get a regular series, which I got as Unknown Soldier. The third was to create a series and have it be published. And I did that with, I believe, Claw the Unconquered was the first one. Because Conan was very popular at Marvel, and
right.
I was asked, "Well, can you do something to do something that can, you know, be a competition to Conan?" And I really didn't want to write Conan, so I tried to do a more of a Michael Moorcock Eternal Champion core. What is it? Someone tell me what was his Stormbringer, the sword.
Elric.
Thank you, Elric. Something more with fantasy in it. And so I at that point I had reached my three goals. So where did I go then? So, I just kept creating and writing and getting the checks. So
right. Now, when did the transition come where you went from when did Marvel come and knock in and go, hey, David, we would like to hire you for your talent, sir.
Well, I did the knocking because I was.
Oh, you did the knocking. Okay, gotcha.
I did the knocking because I was kind of something happened with Star Hunters, and I don't want to mention names because it involves people that aren't around anymore, and I don't want to put any bad. But I was kind of screwed over, and I got ticked off, and they were going to do something about this. And then they didn't, knowing that I would have quit, and I did. So I had met Jim Shooter a couple of weeks before that at an industry party or get-together or something, and I called Jim, and I said, could I get some work at Marvel? And his exact response was, would the day be too soon? So I was I was very, very flattered because I didn't feel like I was being treated all that well at the end at D.C., and this was like a revelation. Someone wants me. Someone appreciates
me. And
this
is about what time? What about? 78.
78,
okay.
Yeah. I had worked for DC for 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Now you moved to Marvel, and what's the very first thing that they put you on?
Well, that was scary and very fortuitous. The first actual assignment I got was Iron Man, but before I did that, Jim Shooter. He had just recently become editor-in-chief, and he was writing Avengers, and he was getting to the point where everything was getting so late, and he couldn't really do it. And my first actual writing I did was I scripted 3 issues of the Avengers over Jim's plots. Now,
wow.
They were – yeah. Jim had he was just so overworked that he wasn't even writing the plots down. He would call the plot into the penciler – and tell him the plot over the phone, the penciler would make notes. And when I came in to do that, he would do the same thing to me. The pencil is, well, back then there was something called the Marvel style, which is basically you did a plot. The story was penciled. The story was told by the penciler. The pencils were sent to the writer. He would write, he or she would write the dialogue, the captions and everything. Then it would go to a letter and then to an inker. These days, they almost exclusively write full script. It's like a movie script. Panel one, this happens. Here's the dialogue. Panel two, this happens. But at this time, so I would be given like 70-page story of pencils without a written plot. And Jim would get on the phone with me and do the same thing. Okay, here's what's happening here. Here's what's happening here. And I would take notes. Hmm. And the thing of it is, I hadn't hardly ever read any of the superheroes at Marvel. I was, you know, Conan, Silver Surfer, Namor, all the off-the-wall characters, like when I was growing up. So I didn't know these guys. Jim knew them backwards and forwards. And he would tell me, this person is doing this. Because of this, this person, okay, the Beast doesn't sit in a chair in meetings. He hangs from the ceiling because he's the Beast. These people do this, these people that. And it was an education in 3 issues on the superheroes of Marvel because most of them were in this Korvac saga, which was the first part where I was writing this. So it was the best possible thing. It was terrifying because I hadn't read these characters, but it was the best possible thing because by the time I did those 3 issues, I knew the characters. So when Jim finally had to realize that he couldn't do this anymore and he turned over the whole series to me, plotting and scripting,
right.
I knew the characters well enough that I could handle that. And I knew the Marvel Universe at that stage that I could do the stories in it. So it was pretty cool.
Now, for you, were you starting when that happened? Were you starting to consume some of the Marvel material? I mean, as far
I had
story?
To,
right?
I had to. Well, you got back then. You got if you got comp copies. So every month I would, or every couple of weeks, whatever, I would get the new comics.
Right.
I would read pretty much every one of them because you really had to. It wasn't that huge. They didn't have like 47 Spider-Mans and 22. You know?
Yeah, right.
So it wasn't that difficult. And you had to know, and you could, you know, where the other characters were going. There weren't these huge crossovers. And when there were something special, not like every month. So, yeah, I read pretty much everything that Marvel came out with.
Now, you worked on that series for how long?
It's about a year and a half, I think. It wasn't a long run.
Well, that's still pretty.
In that first run, is that when you created Scott Lang, or is that?
It was during that time because I know he was.
So that was your first character that you created with Marvel, then.
Probably, yeah, as far as I can recall.
That's a big one.
No, I was going to say, that is a big one, because your version of Ant-Man is the one that is in the movies at this point.
You wrote Paul. You created Paul Rudd.
You created Paul Rudd.
I went to the premiere of Ant-Man. Unfortunately, I wasn't invited to the after party, but I wanted to so I could go up to Paul Rudd and say, hey, I created you.
Now, I'm assuming that must be quite a rush to see your character that you put so much love into just be on the big screen like that. Must be. It's got to be.
Absolutely. I mean, there are those who say, oh, you should get money for this, and you created this, and blah, blah, blah. And they're right. But but it's still a thrill to know that something you've written that you created is valued enough that they would want to put it into a big-time movie.
Right, right.
So, and they... I really enjoyed the movie. I thought they got it right. They got the humor. They got the relationship between Scott and his daughter. I thought it was a thoroughly entertaining movie.
Awesome. Good.
I was happy.
That's good to hear.
I'm glad he enjoyed it.
Can
yes,
I
sir.
Ask a question on the valuing tip? How does it make you feel? I mean, you know, you're talking about how it's validating when people value your product.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a collector. I'm a comic dealer. How does it make you feel? Like today I sold a copy of Amazing Spider-Man 300 in excess of $300.
It makes me wish I had bought a few dozen copies when it came out.
You don't have any comp copies just laying around?
I did, but over the years I've given them to friends and fans and stuff, and I've got maybe two or three copies. I always keep two copies of anything that I write. Just, you know, one for my own stack and one for a stack of stuff that I keep of stuff that I read, so that I can say, okay, I did that with my life. I did something. Right. So,
or like right now I'm looking at a copy of the Iron Man 128, which is the pinnacle of the Demon in the Bottle.
Demon in the Bottle.
Yeah.
Demon in the Bottle is probably one of that is the Iron Man story that hooked me.
I've got a customer question about that arc too afterwards.
Oh yeah, because you could probably go along with this. First off, I will get into Iron Man because I want to ask that. But first, what was it about Hank Pym that you said, hey, listen, we need
the you're not the Ant-Man.
We're
for
not
us.
The Ant-Man anymore. What was that?
Oh, it was nothing. I just because Ant-Man wasn't being used. Hank Pym was off doing something else. So I don't remember Marvel said there's, you know, Ant-Man's available or something, but you know, it wasn't there, so I came up with someone else.
Right. He's probably ruining something, like creating Ultron or
sure he was.
He's always messing stuff up.
He's always
up.
Screwing stuff up, I tell you. So you brought Scott Lang back to bring Ant-Man back because Hank was just hanging around being a scientist.
Scott Lang.
Created Scott Lang.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
Created Paul Rudd.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. That's interesting, and that leads me into the Demon in the Bottle. That is, for me, that's probably the story that hooked me into Tony Stark and Iron Man, because I always, and I've said this on the show before, because that story that you wrote about the alcoholism was a big deal to me, because it showed for me that comics could be deep as far as content, because he was essentially fighting himself about his values and what he was doing as an arms dealer, a weapons dealer, and I really connected to that. I was like, you know, so he didn't know how to handle it, and he would turn to the bottle and things like that. Was really impressive. It's interesting how as a comic book reader, I'm always drawn to the ones where I say this, and I don't mean to be glib about it, but substance abuse issues. Like I said, Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams, the Green Lantern, yeah. the Green Arrow, and Speedy, and those were very impressionable on me as a youngster. And then, of course, yours was like that for me kind of solidified that Tony Stark, although a superhero, was really he was human, and I really, you know, that was something that was really affecting for me as a reader. I really enjoyed Tony Stark at that point.
Well, you say he's a superhero. He is a superhero, but he has no superpowers.
Right, exactly.
His superpower is his brain. He's
right.
Really smart,
yeah.
But he's just a human.
Right. So. Yeah, I just it, so mm-hmm. solidifying, and it's so interesting that it's that those that's that Tony Stark story is the one that got me into Tony Stark. And mm-hmm. you would think that, you know, that would turn most people off or something. That was the one I was like, I like this guy. He's like
a drunk. I like
he's,
him.
He's, yeah, he's
that's why I keep getting ass packed on this show.
That's right.
Todd, you're deeply flawed. you're great for the podcast.
Yeah, you're great for the show. To come to Marvel and go, hey, listen, I'm going to take Tony and I'm going to bring him, put him in a direction that some may find controversial. Is that something that Marvel's like, we're on board, or did you have to fight tooth and nail to get that done, or how did that work for you?
Well, the first assignment I got, as I mentioned, was Iron Man.
Yeah.
At that point, I had never read an Iron Man story in my life. Mm. I was paired with a friend of mine, Bob Layton, on Inks, and we decided to co-plot because Bob wanted to be more involved. Mm. And I had never read Iron Man, and he had read every single Iron Man story. So it was a good pairing because I could, you know, think up ideas, and if they had already been done, he would know it. So no, we can't do that. But I would have a fresh perspective. And I read like the last previous half dozen issues before mine, and I looked at this character, and I thought, my gosh, his company is threatened with a hostile takeover. The government wants to run the Avengers. His love life is in the toilet. What would a real human being do?
Right, right.
He would need stress relief, something to you know, ease the pressure.
Right.
Now, these days it might be designer drugs or cocaine or something, but sure, back in the late 70s, alcohol. And it had been established that Tony Stark is a playboy and he's a party guy and he drinks. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, wouldn't he keep turning more and more to this to get some kind of relief from the situation and the stress? Mm-hmm. And I talked over with Bob and he liked it. And we went to Jim Shooter, and to his credit, Jim Shooter, the only thing he said was, do it well. We were given no problems, no restriction, just
wow,
do it well.
Wow.
Which, of course, we had hoped to do anyway.
For sure.
Did you get more like creative freedom from editorial at DC or Marvel, do you think?
I don't feel I had a lot of restrictions at DC, but I had a lot more encouragement at Marvel.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Now, the way that you write stories, when you come together with an artist, especially for something like that, how does that collaboration work? I'm kind of curious because that seems to be kind of a give and take, regardless of whether you're writing. You know, that's why I admire Todd's work so much, because you know when you're writing and you're drawing, it's not easy. This is, you know, so you know, collaborating is probably the, I mean, it's got to be an interesting give and take.
It's not easy. That's why I drink.
There you go.
I want to hear some of the arguments you have with your artists.
I draw stuff. Well, I always write stuff, and then I overwrite, and then I try to draw it, and I'm like, "This is so stupid. What's this? Why did you write so much? You can't fit that in a comic page. And now you got to cut it. And now nothing makes sense." Idiot.
Well, I was lucky. I only wrote
them. Yeah.
But so did Bob say, hey, listen, or Bob Layton would say, listen, this is great. Can we change this around to do this? Maybe it can fit into what I'm going to do? Or did you guys have...
Well, he didn't pencil them.
Oh.
Initially, it was John Romita Jr.
Oh, Romita Jr. was doing those.
Later on, after John left, Bob did some of the penciling.
Oh, wow.
So did Jackson Guy, so did Mark Bright in our second run. But initially, it was Bob and I came up with the plots, and we'd send them into the editor, and they'd give it to John Romita Jr. There wasn't. I'm not sure how much involvement Bob had with John. I mean, I knew John, but I didn't work with him. And
right.
Mostly, he was given the plots and did terrific job in drawing them. And he was a great storyteller, and he caught the spirit of what we were trying to do. So it was a great combination. But I didn't really work directly with John very much.
Oh, okay. Did you enjoy working with John Romita Jr. and all those guys? Was that something that you enjoyed doing on a daily basis?
All those guys, huh?
Yeah, John Romita Jr.
John Romita Jr., I did.
Really? You did? I was going to say, he just drops that name like nothing.
You never know when people who had worked at Marvel and DC do not get along together. I think Amy had like a funny little yeah. No, because Rubenstein is a friend of ours.
Absolutely
and,
is.
And she said she talked to somebody at a con who was not very happy with Rubenstein at the moment. So it's like, you never know when you're going to stumble upon some surprise friction that you don't know about.
That's true. Yeah. That's a good, that's a good point. It's a good point.
So nice going, G.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah. Sorry, I really screwed the pooch on that one. Now,
yeah, so now let's talk about all the other creators you don't like.
No, let,
can I get a list?
Now let's go on to, there's a, I won't talk about the one of your most iconic characters from Marvel, of course, and that would be you, sir, are the creator of Venom for the Spider-Man universe, the Rogues Gallery. When did that come about? And when did you say that this was the guy I want for Spider-Man? When did you say, hey, listen, he needs another villain for the Rogues Gallery? When did that happen?
It wasn't like that at all. I was writing Web of Spider-Man before Amazing, working for Jim Owsley as editor, and just, you know, coming up with ideas and subplots and stuff. I came up with an idea about. I mean, I try, as I've said many times before, when I write a character, I try to utilize their unique elements. Mm. Spider-Man's totally unique element was his spider sense, because he had strength and he had acrobatics and he was smart, created his web shooters and everything. He could crawl walls. That's pretty unique. Mm. But he had this spider sense, which has saved his life. To the point where it was like, the doctor tapping your knee to get the reflexes. Mm-hmm. He didn't even think about it. When there was danger, it tingled, he jumped.
He didn't use it in the new movie.
I noticed.
I like how he's setting this up, because I only recently just watched the first actual appearance of Venom, which is actually in Web of Spider-Man 18. It's not Amazing Spider-Man 300.
Wow.
Which is why he's talking about the spider sense.
Well, that's interesting. So what's give us a little backstory on that.
Well, that's what I say. I figured it would be interesting to have a villain who was very evil and wanted to kill Spider-Man but didn't trigger his spider sense. How would that affect Peter Parker's sense of confidence, sense of safety? Right. And I had done it, and I figured, well, okay, the symbiote, the alien symbiote from Secret Wars, it had been established, doesn't trigger his spider sense because it came in the night and got on him and moved him around and so forth. So I had actually two teasers in Web of Spider-Man setting up the characters. One is the one Alika just mentioned. Which was that? Was that
he gets pushed off the train platform.
Right. That was the first one. That was the only one that I actually wrote. He's on a train, subway platform. A hand comes out of the crowd, pushes him in front of the train.
And he's just like, why didn't I notice that?
Yeah.
Whoa.
He leaps.
Cool.
He saves himself, but he says, my spider sense didn't work. Is it going away? What's going
on? Interesting. Okay.
And then there was a second one that I actually didn't write. I had plotted, but it was drawn. I had switched over to Amazing at that point, and someone else actually scripted it, where Spider-Man is on the side of a building. A hand comes out of a window, grabs him by the ankle, and yanks him off and throws him off. Of course, he saved himself with his web and everything. But again, his spider sense, is it malfunctioning? Am I losing this? So when I was switched over to Amazing, the editor was Jim Salicrup at that point. Issue 300 was coming up. So I was asked, he wanted to do something special, maybe introduce a new character. And so I said, oh, I was setting this up in Web, and I mentioned what I wanted. And at the time, it was a totally different civilian character. I had had, the origin was a woman. It was going to be a female character.
Okay.
And she had been pregnant and about to give birth, and her husband went out to wave down a cab, and it turns out the cabbie was watching. I was tying it in with a graphic novel called Revenge of the Living Monolith, and the cabbie was watching Spider-Man fight the living monolith, and he didn't see the guy, and he hit him, and he killed the husband, and the woman was so traumatized that the baby was born dead, and she went into a catatonic.
Holy cow!
Yeah, a catatonic,
state.
Very good, thank you. And New Jersey, right? No. I'll get letters.
That's the Garden State.
Yeah. Oh, I get them confused. Yeah. But anyway.
The Catatonic States, Pennsylvania.
Okay, send your letters to Todd.
Yeah, right, yeah. Just kidding, Pennsylvania. I've never been there. Sorry.
I have. Yeah.
So just anyway. Eddie Brock's a Philly guy. No, I don't know.
Anyway, so Jim wasn't sure at the time that if readers could
accept... That is a pretty brutal...
Well, not that, but accept a female character standing standing toe-to-toe with Spider-Man physically. Wow. That was a different time.
Right.
Send those letters to Jim.
And that that was in
89.
I don't remember.
The comics release date, I think, was late 88.
Okay.
But the Black Cat's around still, like before, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but you gotta
talk to Jim.
Well, I will. I'm gonna be the first one to send him that letter.
When you think about Venom and Spider-Man, it's like that's almost like his Joker. Like you know, like how like Venom completely complements Spider-Man, and for a villain to have come around so late in the, you know, his canon, and for that villain to be so perfectly, you know, matched to him, like I grew up, that was the main relationship when I was a kid, is Spider-Man versus Venom, and sure. I thought all those stories were super interesting.
Now, something as iconoclastic as Venom is, and seeing the success of that creation, what was that like? I mean, just seeing it, Venom. I'm assuming that at the time it was great, but after every decade, it seems to be picking up momentum, and everybody starts appreciating Venom more and more and more, until, of course, we got Spider-Man 3, which we won't talk about.
The best incarnation of Venom I've ever known.
Well, the only one so far on
it. Yeah, the only one.
Yeah.
So best and worst.
Topher Grace, what a Venom.
What a Venom. What a
Venom. Venom was okay, but Eddie Brock a little.
Yeah. Now, for Venom to have survive the Rogues Gallery, as it were, and be as iconic as he is now. And he is, like Alika said, for some, he is probably the villain.
You know,
of
mean,
Spider-Man.
If you were lived through the 60s, then Green Goblin is the Spider-Man villain,
right?
Because that's what happened back then. But then, like, I'm a 90s kid. You know, I was born in the 80s, and so Venom is just that to me. That's Spider-Man's main villain. That's his the one guy who could take him down. You know?
Yeah, I've always been, like I said,
because of the video game. because of Maximum Carnage.
Yes, exactly.
Well, for me, it was always I'm a decade back. I'm a Mysterio guy. Always has been. Always will be.
Stop trying to be.
I'm just telling you. I always have
obscure.
Been. I'm no. I'm. It's not obscure. He was always my favorite. He was always my favorite Spider-Man villain. But when I saw Carnage come along, Carnage, I always thought he was almost too scary.
Because he was a psycho?
Yeah, I almost thought he was too scary to take on Spider-Man.
So that's something I have as a fan of the 90s Spider-Man stuff, that, you know, your run, and so it's the second longest run aside from Sandman Spider-Man, meaning, like, you owned the crap out of Spider-Man for a while. And so you ran through all of his rogues, and, you know, like, all of these characters, I mean, you created Venom, but there was all these pre-existing characters that you masterfully used them to... You know, true to their characters and stuff like that. I mean, that must have been a difficult thing to do, to take this pre-established canon and then come up with a new way for them all to be together. Or
is there a question there?
No. I'm just curious how you take that pre-existing canon and not only be faithful to it, but also put yourself into it. You know, and make
it was out of love. I mean, I Spider-Man was my favorite superhero character ever, and it was my dream job to write Spider-Man, especially Amazing Spider-Man. So being able to take those characters that I had read and do new stories with them was just such I'm sorry, there was someone at the door. It was a joy and a treat.
Yeah.
So I enjoyed it so much that it didn't seem to be much of a problem.
For sure.
What was the first Amazing Spider-Man comic that you read?
That I read?
Yeah, do you remember? Or, I mean, it doesn't have to be like the number, but like, what was the story about?
I think I know close to the number because I was in college. I had given, when I was 14, I gave my comic book collection away because I was supposed to grow up.
Was that from your folks, I'm guessing?
I think it was just pressure, peer pressure folks and everything. You're supposed to grow up. And at that point, comics were considered for kids.
Right.
And I didn't discover them when I was 20, I think. And I was playing in a rock band, and our bass player was 21, and we were sitting in his living room once, and he was sitting on a trunk, and he had to open it up and get something, and it was full of comics. I thought, oh my God, you read comics? He said, oh yeah, Marvel Comics, you know, Spider-Man, he's really good. He's like a real person, you know. He runs to catch a cab, and the cab goes right by, and you know, and splashes mud on him, just like a real person. And all this. So I went to a convenience store, and they had a spinner rack, and they actually had two issues of maybe, I think it was 65 and 66.
Oh, wow.
I'm not sure. So I picked them up. I went home, and I read them, and I thought, oh my God, this is really good. I love this. And I became an instant Spider-Man fan, and then started looking at there was a used bookstore that had a stack of frequently coverless comics, and I picked up all the Marvels I could find, and I read everything I could. And so that's how I got into Spider-Man, why he was my favorite.
Well,
so okay. you went from reading Spider-Man 65 to writing Spider-Man 300. Amazing.
The first issue you wrote was 205,
yeah.
Right?
I think you guys are missing, you're glossing over everything right now. You were in a rock band?
I play guitar, yeah.
Fantastic. And what was the name of the group?
I didn't name it. I joined it. They were called The Rogues.
Oh, The Rogues.
Wow.
What were you playing? What were you guys playing? Were you guys rock?
We were a cover band for the most part.
Okay.
Played some Rolling Stones, mm-hmm. Rascals.
Love the Rascals.
Tried to do a little Hendrix and failed miserably. like that. And some standards.
You're in a rock band. You're writing poetry. You must get all the ladies. There's no way back then you weren't.
I was incredibly shy.
Oh, okay.
And I was incredibly grateful when I did get them.
Gotcha. All right. That's very cool. The Rogues, I like it. I like it a lot.
Oh, thank you.
Now, I wanted to touch on, well, not just, I wanted to talk about Venom and get to your question from your...
I was reading through them. They're very Iron Man heavy.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we have a couple because we're running out of time here.
Sure,
but
yeah,
of
sure.
course, I did want to touch on that. You're also responsible. Maybe some people don't know is that you're responsible for two of the most iconic weddings in the history of most Marvel and DC.
Yeah.
You wrote the Lois Lane Clark Kent wedding.
A little part of it.
And then, of course, you also did the Peter
Amazing
Parker
Spider-Man
and
Annual
Mary
21.
Jane.
I did the script, not
right.
the plot.
Oh, you did the script.
Yeah.
Now, those are pretty iconic comics. I mean, consider
it. Yeah, there was one guy who kept calling me Preacher because I kept marrying.
Well, don't you think it was about time? I mean,
listen, I could not agree with you more.
Made an honest woman
made
out of her.
Made an honest yeah. woman out of her, for sure.
Took 25 years.
Only to have Mephisto annul the marriage. Thanks a lot, Bendis.
Thanks.
No, wait, was it Slott? Who wrote Brand New Day? It's one of those guys.
It's probably, I think it was Bendis.
Yeah.
Bendis. I don't know.
That's too funny. Now, do you,
well, yeah.
In this, now, you, it is in 2017, and why, or two, in the 2000s, now, you're watching your work. It's 2017, it's 2000s, I should say.
Next 2018 is going to be
2017. You're watching your life's work be, it's, that must be, for me, I'm thinking to myself, that must be extremely reassuring and feel tremendous knowing that your work is just living beyond
so,
your expectations.
So, I mean, the main question is, why aren't you as pompous as GX?
Yeah, why are you such a nice guy?
Yeah, why are you so nice?
I'm an actor.
Okay. There it is. Because, I mean, you know, creating Scott Lang, creating Venom, creating amazing stories for Iron Man and making them part of what we know as the Marvel Cinematic Universe is just, for you, I mean, it must be just, you obviously inspired these new Marvel, these new guys at Marvel to, you know, like the Kevin Feiges and like all of these guys to really, you know, your writing really inspired them to put it up on the big screen. And I mean, to have those stories, that must be quite amazing. And for people to even know these stories after so long, it's not very often that characters, multiple characters in that respect, to live on like the way you have written them, especially in these comics, especially for Marvel. Does that, I mean, how do you comprehend that? I can't even think about that. It's amazing. You've written it so long ago.
Thank you.
Yeah. That was it's 80s, 90s, you know, I'm just saying. It's like, you know.
Hey, it's hard not to gush when you grew up through the 80s and 90s and David Michelinie's right here.
Yeah, exactly. So that must feel pretty darn good for you.
I don't know how much, you know, my work inspired these guys. I mean, you know, the movies aren't exactly like what I did.
Sure.
But if there's some stuff, I'm flattered, of course. You know, something to know that's, you know, work that I did just, A, to have fun because I love telling stories, and B, to make a living, were enjoyed enough by people that they, you know, it's influenced them even a little.
Right. Now, are you working on anything now other than comics, or are you working on books? Are you just doing the Comic-Con touring, or what are you? What do you got?
There was something that you had just recently shown me that hasn't been. You know, you're not publishing it yet, but
we need a publisher.
Yeah, he's working with an artist on some, and the story is incredible. I'll let you tell it, but the art just helps bring it to life too.
Oh, there's a story called the Lunoir Saga, Lunoire, that I wrote with an artist in Spain named Cesar Medaro, and we did it, you know, across the ocean and just for fun, and it's the kind of thing we'd love to do more stories on, but we haven't been able to find a publisher for. So everybody, go to your comic store and demand that they publish stock.
Hey. I demand that you order that book tomorrow, Alika.
All right. Well, take your batter elsewhere because I would gladly carry that comic.
It's amazing. I mean, it's one of those things where I'm guessing that writers don't really retire. They just keep writing, I mean, for the rest of their life. Is that what you do?
No. I mean, if you want to, you can write. You know, you're not necessarily going to get published. I mean, these days, I don't write stories because I don't have a market. Nobody wants to publish my stories. So I write songs and I write poems and story poems just to, you know, express things that I feel and things that I want to say. But it's kind of useless to come up with stories. I mean, I was spoiled. I spent 25 years every day getting up and sitting at the typewriter and then the keyboard, pretty much knowing 99% of what I put down is going to get published. I got spoiled. And now I get up and I get an idea and I don't know where to put it. There's no one who wants to publish it. So it's I don't come up with story ideas anymore.
So now now you have multiple – you're not just a writer. You are now an artist. So essentially
– I'm a published poet. Poems have been published.
That is amazing. That is absolutely amazing.
I didn't get any money for it.
But hey, you know.
Published.
Published.
Yeah, money.
Oh, nothing. Well, listen, before we go, Alika, why don't you ask one of those questions on your list for Mr. Michelinie. You be prepared to relive some of what you wrote.
I'm just gonna run through them real quick, and we can pick the most important one. But there's five. That's why regarding Demon in a Bottle and Armor Wars, they did follow ups and sequels to those two storylines. They, you know, how Marvel does. They like to rechew the gum every so often.
Not the Marvel I love.
What did you think of in terms of the follow-ups and how faithful they were to the foundation that you had laid and things like that?
You want me to answer?
Yeah, did you have any personal opinions?
I almost, when I leave a book, I almost never read it because the next person up may write great stories, but they're not going to write what I wanted to write. So it saves some depression.
And then there was in Iron Man 227, there's a celebrity charity auction with Lionel Richie, Hulk Hogan, is this true? Don Johnson, Michael J. Fox, Peter Falk, to name a few. Whose idea was that for that?
It was probably something that Bob Layton and I came up with, because we worked so well together because we amused each other.
Sure.
We had come up with stuff.
That's, as you can tell, this is from a fan. It was definitely a treat for him.
We were fans, too.
Yeah. The name that sticks out the most is, of course, Columbo himself. Peter Falk. No,
Peter
for me, it's Peter
really?
Falk.
Peter Falk? Starts, I thought Don Johnson was a funny one to be.
I don't even know if it was Peter Falk. There were, I think, was it Mark Bright who's penciling it? I'm not sure, but the caricatures or the likenesses, you know, people kept guessing, and who is this person? Who is that person? So I don't know if Peter Falk was actually in it. It may have been someone else, and he just didn't recognize it.
That's pretty Falk. Crazy.
And Iron Man 140 and 141, Bethany Cabe drawn in a black bikini. Whose idea was that? Just curious.
Bob loved drawing women in bikinis.
Well, we got the answer to that one. Bob Layton right there.
There it is right there.
Your favorite Iron Man armor and least favorite?
Ooh.
And he states his personal favorite is the Scarlet Centurion and Space Armor V1 and the Red and Gold Classic,
hey,
of course.
You only have one favorite.
I know, yeah. He's got three favorites, apparently.
Well, my favorite is the red and gold that he had it when I started writing the book. I don't have a least favorite.
Oh, wow. Cool. Yeah. You like them all. All right,
I didn't say that. I just didn't have a least favorite.
Oh, you have a least favorite. Okay, got it.
Like them all. Come on. You like them all.
All right, last but not least, one of, curiously.
Oh, wait, hold on.
Yes.
And those questions were from Stan Emsley. I just want to give him a shout out. Great supporter of the store. Great guy. Wish he could be there.
Can I ask one more question?
Can you ask one more question?
That was it. Okay, you're done.
I want to ask one question, and you can ask one question.
Okay.
I asked this question for a friend of ours who is on this podcast all the time. He's standing over there. His name is Gannon. You worked for DC for quite some time. Have you ever worked on his favorite superhero or his favorite hero? Have you ever worked on the Dark Knight, Batman himself?
I didn't do any actual Batman stories, but I did guest star him, and I know at least one. Superman story in Action Comics.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Do you like when they work together, Batman and Superman? Is that something, or did you just like the tension between the two when you had them in your comic?
Two questions now.
I know. It is two questions.
Your own rule.
Yeah.
But to answer it, I did a fair amount of Superman story. I did 3 years of Action Comics, but I actually guest starred him in an Aquaman story too, but I've never, he's one character that I would have loved to have written on a regular basis, never could have. And I do like the dynamic between the goody two shoes Superman and the use brutality if you have to Batman. I like they're both going for the same thing, but they're taking different roads. I like that kind of conflict between them.
For sure.
You just have to imagine what a Michelinie Batman run would have been, because I don't know if, I'm sure you're very proud of it and just too humble to admit, but like, it seems like every run of every major superhero that you've touched becomes an iconic run. Because, you know,
that's very
Iron
true.
Man,
yeah.
Avengers, you know, the Spider-Man run. So it's like, imagine if, and we're just guessing as fanboys right now, what a Batman, like what kind of brutal stuff you would have had him go through. You know what I mean?
Wow. All
Jason
right.
Todd would have died a lot sooner.
Batman just got sick of him and killed him.
Just,
all right,
just
Todd.
Slaps him too hard one time and just.
Todd, go ahead. Your one question, sir.
Just as a. I really admire some of the artists that you've worked with in the past. And I was just wondering if there's any particular artist that stands out as your favorite or least favorite, I guess.
I won't name the least favorite, but I know it.
You can tell me off the podcast.
But I was so blessed to get artists. I mean, I started on Avengers. I got George Perez and then John Byrne.
Yeah.
Wow.
Iron Man, John Romita Jr.
Yeah.
Spider-Man, Todd McFarlane. I mean, you know. God, you know, I could have gotten so many bad artists, and I got so many good ones. I was just so lucky. No, I like most of them. Most of them, I like if they're good storytellers, and I think all those that I mentioned are good storytellers.
Yeah.
So I enjoy that very much.
And of course, none of the guys you named came anything in this business, so obviously.
Yeah, well, that was probably the height of it, right?
Yeah. I made them star.
Absolutely.
There we go.
Absolutely.
That's the Michelinie I want to see.
Well, listen, Mr. Michelinie, right before you go, I do have one question for you.
Oh, no.
No,
you already had another. You had
this is the last one because I got 2 minutes left.
You made two with your last
one. I know. I guess there is. This is a two-part question. Number one.
Oh God.
Do you have any regrets in the business? Number two.
The Nerdwatch podcast.
Yeah.
Working with his least
one,
favorite
except
artist.
Because this is a definite regret for sure. But number one, do you have any regrets in your time in the business? And number two, is there a character that you never had the opportunity to write in the business that you wish you did?
Okay, the answer to the first one is yes. The answer to the second one would be there's no character that I know of that I haven't written. Captain America and Batman I would have liked to have written a series of, but I did get to write both of those in like individual stories.
Yeah.
And nobody laughed when I just said yes, so I guess I better give you a better answer.
I regret working with my least favorite artist, is what he...
You know, and I don't want to mention any names here, but I kind of regret not leaving Amazing Spider-Man a little sooner. Mm. Because I was... The editorial... the editor changed, and the new editor, Jim Salicrup, had given me a lot of freedom. And the new editor... I ended up doing a lot of stories he wanted, not necessarily that I wanted. And I stayed because I love Spider-Man so much, but I wasn't as happy. And I kind of wish, I think the quality would have been, I should have left when the quality hadn't deteriorated a little bit.
Well, if there isn't, I certainly don't think that the quality that you brought to the comic book business has deteriorated. All your stories are extremely iconic, and it inspired all of us to read them, and is still today inspiring millions of other people through comics and on the big screen. So thank you very much for your contribution, and thank you to you for giving us such great entertainment and providing us a wonderful way to grow up and to learn how to read, because comics is one of the ways I learned how to read. So we thank you for that so much. So, ladies and gentlemen, David Michelinie, give the man a hand if you can. Thank you so much for coming, sir. We certainly do appreciate it. Where can we visit you? Are you online? Are we going to be at another con sometime? Where can we see you?
Well, first off, thank you for having me. I'm always very flattered. People want to listen to what I have to say. But I'm going to be at the amazing Hawaii Comic Con.
Fantastic.
This coming weekend. That's the only appearance I have scheduled.
We'll see you there.
Yeah.
I'm on Facebook. Don't have a website. We'll probably be sitting home watching television a lot.
Catching up on Game of Thrones and Defenders.
Absolutely.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, David Michelinie, thank you so much, sir, for coming by.
Yes.
We certainly do appreciate you gracing the Nerdwatch podcast this evening. And if you can't believe it, we actually went an hour. I can't even believe it.
Thank you so much, David.
So, you're very welcome.
We so appreciate it. Well, you get some rest, sir. You've been busy. You've been working that autograph all day long here at Molly Comics and Collectibles. So... thank you so much for coming. We certainly do appreciate it. We'll be back in a little bit. We got more with the Nerdwatch podcast coming up in just a few minutes. So stay tuned for that as well. So until next time, peace out. Much love, and most assuredly, always stay nerdy. And until next week, we say to you guys, aloha.
Aloha.
Not Utah.
Demon in a bottle.